This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we've had David Reich with us from the Gary Public Transportation Corporation on the air on some of the recent events that have happened. Some of them were, at the time, centered around the Lake County Fair earlier this summer. But today we're talking about another project that Dave and his staff and colleagues there at GPTC are working on. And thank you first for joining us on the program today, David.
It was a pleasure to get the invite, and I am glad to be here.
Well, you mentioned at least that you start out, I guess, in our previous conversation, talked about some of the improvements that are being made in the Broadway Metro Express in particular. It's been underway for, I guess, for the service itself has been going on for, I guess, about a year and a half now. And we talked about the changes that were being made then. And I know that a lot of this is a continual planning process, and a lot of these plans, I know, and in particular with this route that you were talking about there in, and I guess basically running from through Maryville and then to Crown Point, deals with expansion for just rapid bus service in general here in the region. What were some of the topics that you all had brought up here, I guess, in the months previous to this next session, which is going to be coming up here on September 23rd?
Okay. Thank you for asking. Mm-hmm. Last time we talked, in addition to talking about the Lake County Fair Service, we'd mentioned that we had submitted a grant to the state for battery electric buses. That's something that I guess would be a next phase in sustainability for public transportation. We actually had an inkling at the time of our conversation before, but we actually did get approval just after that conversation, and we will be receiving an $800,000 grant as a part of the mitigation settlement for Volkswagen. So we've already signed those papers with the state of Indiana and are looking for the next step in that. That would be selecting a vendor and actually ordering the vehicles. We're going to be going to Indianapolis, as a matter of fact, in a couple of weeks to visit their shop. Indigo launched a rapid bus service just a couple of weeks ago that actually does have battery electric buses already. So
is that the route that runs from downtown or through downtown and goes north up to the collar counties?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
That's what I thought.
Right. I mean, it's been a success so far. We follow our colleagues, and what their successes are and what they're doing. So they invited us down on the 30th to go over the things that they had to go through in order to implement electric bus service on that corridor. We also wanted to thank the South Shore Clean Cities. They actually assisted us in putting together that application for Volkswagen funds, and they're actually going to be a partner in implementing the battery electric bus project with GPTC. And it's going to focus on the Broadway corridor because that's our highest our highest ridership route. Mm-hmm. So our meeting on the 23rd, it's going to be at 1:30 p.m. at the library in downtown Gary. It's going to be a focus on the partners that were part of the project in the past, stakeholders currently, and the small business community, as a matter of fact, to go over what we've done so far, not just us, but our partners in implementing the improvements on Broadway, not just in transit, but in transit type and transit-related projects, and then figure out some things we could do next.
I know that one of the topics that is going to come up as well, besides the expansion of the service there on the Broadway Metro Express line, is the other changes that the Gary Public Transportation Corporations have been making in other places as well, and including some of the other corridors. Those are changes that will come up and want to have some input on?
Yes. We're going to try to use this meeting to not just talk about the Broadway Metro Express, but also go over how we'd like to prioritize additional changes throughout the entire area. These include whether or not we should start building new bus shelters, throughout our service area. Right now, Gary and Maryville are the only locations that we have bus shelters. But we've got high ridership locations throughout the area, Gary, Maryville, and Crown Point, because we have mm-hmm. bus shelters thanks to Lake County Government at the Lake County Government Center in Crown Point. But Hammond, Highland, Munster are also ridership locations that may deserve some passenger facilities. What we'd like to do over the next few months in particular, but perhaps even over the next year, is go through a conversation and a process of prioritizing how we take public transit to the next level. Can we be identifying corridors for future rapid bus service? I mean, people have talked about Grant Street. People have talked about Indianapolis Boulevard. Should we roll out electric vehicles throughout our service area as we, you know, phase out our older buses? Should we look into increasing frequency on the BMX itself? We've got metrics in place that will trigger the potential for going from 20-minute service to maybe 10 or 15-minute service, similar to the Red Line in Indianapolis. And also how much these would cost, which ones are more important, and maybe starting a conversation on how to pay for these improvements.
One of the other topics I know that also will come up, and it's one of the Legacy Foundation's on the table discussions that are going to be happening here on the 23rd there at the Gary Public Library, is a question which has seemingly always come up, I guess, at one time or another. But I know that you're trying to get more information together, and since you're doing the expansion plans, it is dealing with the question of accessibility.
Mm-hmm. Yes. When we started the Livable Broadway Regional Plan, which is a plan that was funded by the Indiana Department of Natural Resources and the FTA back in 2015. When we did that plan, there was a very important element of it for accessibility. When we selected the locations for our BMX stops and the types of passenger facilities at those stops, we also looked at what we call and what the industry calls universal design. Instead of retrofitting an existing bus shelter or location for those who are differently abled, what if we planned for all types of accessibility when we first put a shelter out there? We did that with the BMX shelters. We also want to do that with, and this meeting on the 23rd will start looking into that, how we improve the trip from a bus shelter to a bus shelter and apartment complexes and neighborhoods and businesses that are close to those locations. We want to eventually be able to measure how accessible the bus stops on Broadway and in other places are, and how accessible the businesses are that are near those stops. Because if a person can't get to a business that's less than a block from a bus stop, they're not going to use that bus stop because that business is not one that they're going to be able to frequent. So we want to make sure that we eliminate those barriers to transit at those first and last mile points before they get on the bus and after they get on the bus, and maybe assist businesses in fixing that.
One of the things I know, and you kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier here in the conversation that is going to, I'm sure, come up here, is the future. You've mentioned some of the plans that are already out there, but I'm sure that you'd like a lot more input and this opportunity coming up with the on-the-table talk, so to speak, mm-hmm. is a way to be able to find out more from not only from stakeholders, but also from citizens about what they'd like to see the GPTC do in the future.
Well, in addition to the on-the-table session on the 23rd, we will be announcing very soon a series of transit talks. Mm-hmm. This was something that we began actually when we started the Broadway Metro Express, because we knew that that route was making some changes people weren't used to. Bus bypass lanes, express service where the bus does not stop at every single intersection in order to increase its speed. We wanted to make sure people could one-on-one ask those questions and get an explanation. That was extremely useful back in early 2018. So we're going to be restarting that in partnership with Everybody Counts Center for Independent Living, as well as some of our other transit partners like North Township Dial-A-Ride and East Chicago Transit. These transit talks will be throughout the service area: Gary, Merrillville, Hammond, East Chicago, perhaps even Whiting and Crown Point. And that will be the venue where people can talk about what works with public transit, what doesn't work with public transit, and what the priorities are for getting us to the next level. Public transit is a quality of life infrastructure element. And even with our ridership increase and with the improvements on the Broadway corridor, Northwest Indiana still lacks, we lack far behind in terms of using public transit, making it something that people don't have to check their watches all the time for, and that will be available at all hours of the day, and will be much closer to their place of residence than they are now. So we want to invite the public to help us prioritize how we can get there.
Are you finding, this has happened over time, I'm sure, the requests from riders, from residents, as well as from you said, the stakeholders, the people that are involved in the whole process, that they are interested in seeing something beyond just maybe an 18-hour schedule, that they'd like to see something more in the lines of a 24-hour schedule someplace? Maybe not every single route, but a lot of them?
Oh, my goodness. That's probably one of the most asked questions.
Mm-hmm.
Our service ends for the most part at 9 o'clock on weekdays, and some routes, you know, they're in the garage at 8 o'clock. Our service on weekends begins at 8 o'clock and ends at 6. We don't have Sunday service. People have to do things on the weekends. People have to do things later in the evening. So in not being able to afford to put service out there after 9 o'clock on weekdays, and after 6 o'clock on Saturdays, and not on Sundays, means that a lot of people who need public transit or, and this is very important, just want to have that option, can't use the service. That's a funding issue. That's probably, you know, spoiler alert, going to be high on the list of priorities once we start having these transit talks. People need to have access during hours that we don't currently serve.
Do you think, too, this is going to help resolve some of the issues, the side issues, if you want to call them that, of such things as food deserts and food insecurity for residents in the area that need that extra service?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, earlier this year, we worked with the Purdue Extension on a survey of our riders to see how they use public transit to solve the food desert issue. There are food deserts in Northwest Indiana, not just in the central communities, but a couple of them in the collar communities. And people use public transit to get from areas with food access issues to groceries, to farmers markets. We've partnered with the Legacy Foundation in their Lake County Eats Local program, which is a farmer's market program in Gary and East Chicago this year. We know people use public transit to solve the food desert issue. We want to make sure that is not too burdensome to get there. From the Metro Center to Strachan Van Til in Maryville, for instance, mm-hmm. from the Metro Center to Fresh County Market at 25th and Grant, from downtown Hammond to the Walmart Supercenter on Indianapolis Boulevard, we know how long it takes someone to travel from one point to another. We want to lower that and also elevate the visibility of that option so people can actually use public transit to get healthy foods. And maybe in the near future, public transit can be an asset in getting healthy food resources closer to where these people live.
And we know that's what the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana would like to be able to see happen the most, along with all the other issues that we have to deal with as well. So a lot literally on the table that's going to come up in these conversations that the Legacy Foundation is sponsoring, and the one that we're talking about in particular here on the 23rd. Will you give us again the particulars about this particular talk that the GPTC is going to be involved in again?
Okay. We actually, first of all, Food Bank of Northwest Indiana is a partner in the Barway Metro Express. When mm-hmm. they moved their facility from one location to their Broadway location, they requested and received and helped pay for a BMX bus stop right there at 64th and Broadway. So they're a very important partner. Hopefully they'll be there at this first On the Table event. It's, again, on Monday, September 23rd. It was going to be at the Gary Public Library and Cultural Center at 5th and Adams in downtown Gary at 1:30. It will be focusing on not just reviewing what we've done and making improvements on the Broadway corridor to transit and livability, but also what we can do to continue to make those improvements. Citizens as well as stakeholders and small businesses are invited to be part of that conversation. Again, 1:30 p.m. at the Gary Public Library and Cultural Center in downtown Gary on September 23rd.
Well, David, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the issues, about how the expansion for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation is coming along, aside from our last conversation we had, but in particular what is going to definitely be talked about at this on-the-table discussion coming up here in Gary very soon. Thank you for spending time with us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much. If anyone has any other questions, they can contact us via social media at Gary Transit for Twitter as well as Facebook. Gary Transit can get you right to our desk to answer any questions about any of these issues.
That's David Wright. He is the Planning and Marketing Director for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, it's time once again for another series of Farm Hop Farm Tours all across Northwest Indiana. They're sponsored by the Northwest Indiana Food Council, and we have with us the president of the Food Council, Ann Massey. Ann, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, for people that are not familiar with the Food Council, explain first what the Northwest Indiana Food Council is all about.
Sure. The Northwest Indiana Food Council, we're a nonprofit volunteer organization where our mission is to build a just, thriving, and sustainable food system for all in Northwest Indiana, and we cover all seven counties of our region.
Now, for folks that aren't familiar with the Farm Hop series of farm tours is all about, how did they get started now 3 years ago now to this year?
Yeah, it's been our third year. We started in, I guess that would be 2017, touring farms that aren't normally open to the public around Northwest Indiana, both urban and rural farms, small vegetable farms, larger corn and soy farms, even animal production. And it just gives everyone an opportunity to see how diverse our farm businesses are around the region and to really dig in to see where your food comes from.
I imagine there are a lot of people that take the tours and they are very, very surprised at what they see. You can't help but not be surprised when you think about a typical farm, you know, and how unique these farms oftentimes are. There's just different types of things that are grown on the farms or animals that are taken care of on the farms. It's all just very amazing. There are two series of Farm Hop tours. One's already happened. It's August 10th. First, tell us a little bit about what happened on August 10th and what kind of response you got from folks that made the tours then.
Oh, absolutely. We've had great feedback from the folks that went on the August 10th tour, which departed from Valparaiso and visited Howe Farms in Crown Point, Acorn Acres Farm in Couch, Indiana, Sunnyside Drive Flowers, which is a slow flower farm, and several large truck farms that grow tomatoes, onion sets, mint, and corn and soybeans in our region. And most of the folks were really surprised at how many of our farms are trying to address really relevant issues like climate change and biodiversity and growing interesting vegetable varieties and heritage breed animals.
Now, for folks that don't necessarily know what a truck farm is, will you explain what that is?
Sure. These large farms we grow a lot of food in our region for large companies like Red Gold or Vlaspik that send in trucks to harvest from a lot of these farms that have thousands and thousands of acres in the southeastern corner of our region.
Mm-hmm. What kind of responses have you gotten so far? We probably continue to get them in. People get back to you on Facebook or on email or with the like, however they reach you on social media to tell you how they enjoyed the particular tours that they were on. What kind of response are you getting from people that have made the August 10th tour?
We actually have quite a few that are signing up for the September 21st tour because they enjoyed the August 10th tour so much. Mm-hmm. And they want to continue to see more and more farms that call Northwest Indiana home. Many of them find, even though it seems like it would be a long day going from 9 to 4, many of them felt like the day went by quickly and that they, pretty much everyone tells us that they had no idea that businesses like this existed in our region and that they're just amazed at how much goes into producing food.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana Food Council President Ann Massey about the 2019 Farm Hop series of tours of farms. There's been already one set of tours on August 10th, another one coming up on September 21st, and we know there's another that's going to come out of Valparaiso. Let's talk about the one that maybe is the one that is the least likely of an area to find farms of this type, and that's out of Gary. That's a very interesting tour, and we know there are some very interested and people who are looking into finding ways to grow food, to treat the environment properly, and have seemed successfully to be able to do so in of all places, Gary, Indiana.
Yes, this tour I cannot speak highly enough of. I think it generally isn't as well attended as we'd like it to be, and I'm not quite sure why that is, because Gary is a thriving center of urban farming activity and innovation. Many of the gardens that are on the tour are resourceful in ways that rural farms don't necessarily have to be. You'll get to visit East Chicago Aquaponics, which is an aquaponics system in the historic greenhouses of Washington Park in East Chicago, where the system is it's a closed system where plants are grown in floating beds on water where they're fertilized from fish waste, and then the clean water goes back into a container of fish, and it's a closed cycle that it's a really neat to behold, and they can grow year-round produce this way with minimal input. One of our partner farms that we do a lot of work with, Faith Farms in Gary, they have an orchard, they have chickens for eggs, they grow all of their produce organically, they even have solar panels on the church next to the farm. And one of our favorite stops is a Rose for Yanina garden, a woman whose front yard and backyard are fully planted with really incredible and unique varieties of plants that you do not find anywhere. She has to special order a lot of her seeds, and it's planted with a permaculture background, so she really highlights the natural resources that are available to her in her urban neighborhood.
Now, before we leave Gary, let's talk about where folks can catch up with the tour. It's going to depart from location in Gary as it makes its way around through the region. Where is it leaving on the 21st to be able to take this leg of the tour?
Sure. The Gary tour departs from Art House Social Kitchen in downtown Gary, just across the street from Railcat Stadium at 9 a.m.
Okay. Now, the other part of the tour on September 21st is going to be departing from Valparaiso. And tell us about that. That's a little bit different from the one tour that was held out of Valparaiso in August.
Yeah. This tour will be departing from the Valparaiso Farmers Market, downtown Valparaiso, at 9 a.m. as well. And you'll get to visit a farm that has 600 egg-laying chickens. It's just, it's an absolute riot to visit because there are chickens everywhere. And the family, I believe, has 8 or 9 children that help all around the farm. It's just, it's really a special place. Triple B Tilapia, they're a fish farm in DeMott, Indiana, and they have a really interesting setup and grow a unique variety of tilapia. So you can get locally raised, sustainably raised fish grown right in our region. Pioneering Pig Homestead and Fairstream Farm, the Pioneering Pig Homestead has everything from honey to grapes to roasting coffee. They do organic vegetables and heritage breed animals. And Fairstream Farm does biodiverse vegetables that are available at farmers markets throughout the area as well.
Now, you're going to need tickets to be able to take advantage of this second leg of the two series tour, Farm Hop for 2019, that leaves September 21st. And tell us how you get tickets and in turn, what that is going to give you in benefits.
Sure. Tickets are only $20. That gets you transportation on the bus, as well as a local food lunch. We do serve lunch on the tours. We offer snacks and water. We try to make it as comfortable as possible. And you can get your tickets at nwifoodcouncil.org. They're on our website, and you just need to reserve them before the tour leaves.
Well, what a great opportunity to see some locally grown food and in turn the produce of some type and animals. We're talking chickens in this case, and in this case, and fish, but also too a chance to see how some very clever urban farmers have been able to take advantage or even some of the disadvantages of their own neighborhoods, depending where you happen to go, and turn it into something that is really worth talking about. And thank you very much for joining us to give us another idea of what the Farm Hop Tours this year is all about.
Oh, thanks so much, Chris.
Ann Massey's president of the Northwest Indiana Farm Council. Again, the second leg of the two-leg Farm Hop 2019 series of tours will be taking place on September 21st. The 2019-2020 edition of the Valparaiso University International Film Festival is just about to begin on the Valparaiso University campus. It's a program, a series of international films introduced by faculty on the VU campus from the Department of World Languages and Cultures and the Department of English. And with us to talk about it, we have Professor Tim Tomasik. And thank you for being with us on the program today.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us about the series in general, how to get started, and some of the interesting films that have been up in past film festivals.
Well, it started back in 2005, and we sort of had a discussion as a department of looking to find ways to maybe boost our presence on campus. And so we thought, well, we all deal with other cultures, and so why not find a way to create a program that might have broad appeal across campus? And so we decided to go along the route of a film festival. And so beginning in 2005, we tried to organize it where we would have three films per semester, so three in the fall, three in the spring, representing the languages that we teach in the department. So we would almost always have a film from France, Germany, either Spain, Mexico, another Hispanic country, something from China, something from Japan, and then for the sixth film, we would sort of reach out to colleagues across campus who might have interest in other areas and other mm-hmm. countries and have them showcase a film from that area. So we always had, I think, the five films representing the languages that we teach and then something from outside of that.
How do you find out about some of these films that are out there? Do you get to screen them? Do you get word or look at reviews from other sources like magazines and the like?
It sort of depends. I think with each language group, they tend to sort of meet and just talk about if there are films that they've heard of, if there's anything that seems to be buzzing at that particular moment in time. Sometimes we'll look and see what, for example, what the foreign film and the Academy Awards, you know, what the nominations were, and maybe take a look at those. In the case of French, which is the language that I teach, there is sort of an ongoing film series sponsored by the French government on American campuses, and so they publish every year their list of the films that they're showing across the country. And so sometimes if I'm looking for a film, I might go to their website and just find out what are the films that seem to be really important or interesting that particular year, and I'll just sort of scan through them and decide and pick one that works. So I think we tend to pick films that are relatively recent, so something that may have come out in the previous 2 or 3 years. We try to pick films that are award-winning in some way. But sometimes we're also picking films that might have a particular relevance to a course that's being taught in a given semester, and so it gives us an opportunity to sort of allow the students in that course to have access to the film in a more public way, but also to share it with the rest of the campus.
Have you had an opportunity to be able to show films at a recent film festival that turned out to be Oscar winners?
The one that we actually have this year on this year's program, the German film that we have, which is called Never Look Away, it's from 2018. It was actually the winner of the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film.
Oh.
And there have been many like that in the past. I can't recall exact titles over the last 15 years of which ones, but I would say every year we probably have at least one, if not Academy Award nominee. We typically have ones that may have won other awards at other film festivals.
Okay. So we should probably mention right now, too, that the one we just talked about, Never Look Away, is going to be coming up here. The screening is going to be on Friday, November 8th. Let's go down the list of, besides the one we just mentioned, of all the films this time around.
So this year we've got coming up in September, September 20th, so this is already next week, we have our Japanese film, which is called Like Father, Like Son. And all of the films for this year are going to be screened on Fridays, beginning at 7 p.m. in the Neil Science Center, room 234. So this is sort of a big lecture hall that we have. It's a good space for film screenings.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the Japanese film coming up next week, October 18th. We have a film that's sort of a joint venture with Spain and Argentina, a film called Truman. And then, as you mentioned, November 8th, we have our German film, Never Look Away. And so that's the series for the fall semester. And then in the spring, coming up on January 24th, we have a French film called The Workshop. And in February 21st, we have a film from China called Duckweed. And then our sort of outside-the-department film for this year is actually coming from Egypt. It's a film called Yomedine, I think, and that's on March 27th.
Wow. Do you get some response from folks that have either heard about these films ahead of the actual screening or watched the film and they have something good to say or bad to say about it?
We for the screenings, we take maybe 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning, and whichever professor is sort of taking the lead on that film will give a little bit of context, a little bit of explanation of where the film's coming from, if there are some particular cultural elements that might be important for an audience to understand before going into the film, they might explain that. And then typically we try to come back to some kind of a discussion at the end of the screening just to see what was the reaction from the crowd, what did they like, what did they not like, see if there are questions that they have. Sometimes some professors will give the audience some leading questions before the screening and then come back to them afterwards. So there's often a good half-hour discussion afterwards where people have a chance to really sort of give their feedback about the film, but also talk about some of the issues that may come out of the film.
That's great. Now, is there someplace people can check out certainly the list of films that are going to be offered in the fall and in the spring semesters and make notes so they can be sure to put that on the calendar to see a film?
We have a web page on our department website, and that's valpo.edu/worldlanguagesandcultures/film, and you can see the entire docket of films for the year. And then I think there is probably a press release on the university website, and there may be other places on the university website where this shows up or where there are at least links to it.
So, that's right. Well, thank you for spending time talking about not only the International Film Festival series that has been going on for years, but also the ones that are up for screening this time around. And we hope that people take advantage of the opportunity to see some interesting foreign films, as they were often called, but certainly international in nature now. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Professor Tim Tomasik, who is with Valparaiso University, talking about this year's, the 2019-2020 Valparaiso University International Film Festival. A telemedicine initiative here in Indiana is making it possible to offer psychiatric care to more patients in remote areas, and it's also helping recruit doctors in a tight labor market. Here's Mary Louise Kelly to introduce you to NPR's Yuki Noguchi and to Dr. Abdul Subhan.
This month in All Tech Considered, we are looking at some of the issues that matter most to rural America. One issue is the shortage of healthcare workers, particularly mental health workers. NPR's Yuki Noguchi discovered one Indiana medical center has found a workaround. It is tackling a shortfall in psychiatrists by using remote care.
On a recent Tuesday morning, psychiatrist Abdul Subhan swivels at his desk, then leans in to face his patient, who sits 60 miles away.
Morning, Ronald.
Morning, doctor.
How are you doing today?
I seem to be doing pretty good.
Seeing his patient this way, through a computer, bridges what would be an hour's drive between Muncie and Subhan's office in Indianapolis.
Hearing voices, any paranoia?
Not here, I don't have any of that.
Okay.
Video conferencing has lowered barriers to medical care. It used to take at least 9 months to schedule an initial appointment with a psychiatrist. Now it takes days. Over the past several years, the number of psychiatric specialists on Meridian Health Services staff, including nurse practitioners, tripled from 4 to 12. Telemedicine has become one of the most promising and lucrative opportunities in healthcare. The way it's transformed both psychiatric care and recruitment for Meridian is a case study of its appeal. Sarfraz Khan is chief medical officer for Meridian, a mental health and primary care provider.
In my opinion, that's life-saving.
Meridian increased its investment in telepsychiatry in the last 6 months, in part because of what Khan says is a burgeoning addiction crisis.
There are drugs, and there are more drugs, and there are more and more drugs.
Along with spikes in depression and suicide. Geographic isolation exacerbates all that. Many rural health systems face a vicious cycle. A shortage of doctors means patients can't get timely care. The health system atrophies and doctor recruitment gets even tougher. Khan says a digital connection can't compete with a local in-person visit. But for many years, that hasn't been realistic.
It definitely makes a difference when somebody's sitting and talking to you. But the problem is it is not there.
So Meridian set up what it calls a hive in Indianapolis, where it's easier to recruit talent. At one end, a nurse measures the patient's vitals and observes their demeanor. A physician at the other end of a secure connection then talks to the patient.
And has it helped your recruitment?
Oh, humongous. Humongous. There was a time when we were seriously considering that would it be viable for us to provide psychiatric services because nobody would like to come to small towns.
Now, such care is readily available, and it makes more money for Meridian because Medicare and Medicaid pay more for care provided to underserved areas. And patients seem to embrace it. At Meridian's offices in Muncie, I meet a visually arresting 20-year-old woman named Mariah. She's wearing a metallic kitty ear headband over a fluorescent green wig that matches her dramatic eyeshadow.
Yesterday, I had heart-shaped freckles that were, like, covered in glitter, and I also had it look like I was crying glitter.
She says the elaborate costumes help her mask a years-long struggle with depression and anxiety. Mariah declined to use her last name to protect her medical privacy. She had just emerged from her first telepsychiatry appointment with a doctor based in Indianapolis. She says she prefers talking over a computer to an in-person appointment.
It's easier because, like, they're not there, so I feel like I can tell more and speak more and truly, like, just be fully real versus if they're sitting right there, I might not want to say everything or say as much.
For all its benefits, telemedicine hasn't solved all of Meridian's recruitment needs. Gerard Cyranowski is one of the company's vice presidents covering the eastern part of Indiana.
There's a lot of demand out there. There's vacant positions. In my offices, I've got probably close to 50 positions that are vacant.
Especially in primary care. So in the past few months, Meridian has started experimenting using telemedicine to solve staffing problems in emergency rooms, addiction treatment centers, and even schools. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
The price of crude oil saw a massive spike on Monday following what were believed to be drone attacks over Saudi Arabian oil facilities last weekend. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson talked with Allison Mack, who is one of the petroleum analysts with GasBuddy.com, and here's her report.
Gas prices naturally have drifted lower for the ninth straight week, according to Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis for GasBuddy. But now he says all eyes now turn to Saudi Arabia after an attack that knocked out over 5% of global oil production. DeHaan says while there is some good news that motorists should not expect a sudden and major uptick in gas prices, there may be a minor impact beginning midweek and continuing until Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil company is able to restore all production. GasBuddy petroleum analyst Allison Mack says overall the nation's prices have not gone up yet.
And to keep things in perspective, we are in the middle of September. So during this time, prices should be going down. This happens year over year. It's no secret that we're switching over to winter blend gasoline, which is a cheaper fuel that's easier to produce, which is why we see prices drop. And on top of that, it is the end of summer driving season. So the demand for gasoline is also dropping, which is why typically during September, October, November, we should be seeing prices continue to drop.
Max says oil prices have the biggest effect on gas prices, and currently there is a unique situation underway.
Saudi Arabia is usually typically the most reliable, most stable country when it comes to producing oil. So when there is a big attack such as the one that happened over the weekend, the market reacts.
Mac thinks people's concerns are that gas prices will be skyrocketing as a result of the attacks on Saudi Arabia, but timing is on consumers' side. She says if the recent attacks were to happen 2 months ago when we were entering the peak driving season, then we would have been seeing drastic spikes. But now peak driving season is over and demand is lower at this time of year. In Northwest Indiana, gas prices have risen just over 5 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $2.52 per gallon Monday, according to GasBuddy's daily survey of 314 gas stations in the region. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. And for this week, I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.